Our first speaker today is Corrine Klaas. She is a solicitor of labor. As solicitor of labor, she is the first woman to hold a top legal position in the department. As solicitor, she directs all of the agency's legal activities under more than 130 federal labor laws and executive orders. A native of Knoxville, Tennessee, and a graduate of Vassar College and Columbia University Law School, Ms. Klaas initiated her government career in 1963. We welcome you, and we're interested in hearing what you have to say. Let me remind you there will be a 20-minute question-answer period after she speaks, so please hold your questions to them.
We're such a small group, which just proves you shouldn't try to compete with a big convention, that I'm going to try to keep this very informal, and I'd like to be responsive in particular to concerns you have about job discrimination, employment, and things that the Labor Department's involved in and that we may be able to help you with. I think, regardless of our small number, that this is an historic occasion for us all to participate in. And like Seneca Falls or a few other great things in history, that I'm proud to be able to say I was here when it happened. I think before I tell you about the department and what we are doing for women and hearing from you as to what more we could be doing, I would like to say just a word about the women who are in appointed positions at the department. I don't want to embarrass you, Alexis, but since you came in, Alexis Herman, the director of the Women's Bureau, which has now been moved to the office of the secretary and has direct access to the secretary and will have policy input and control over all programs affecting women in the department. A very important change that occurred about 3 weeks ago. There is another woman at the department, Eula Bingham, who was scheduled to be here, but I guess is still in Egypt. And she is the Assistant Secretary for Occupational Health and Safety. It's another area of vital interest to women, and she is extremely committed to doing something for women in these areas. Together, the three of us occupy one-third of the top positions in the department. And I was talking earlier to people as they were coming in, and one of the concerns expressed, and I hear this so often, is what can women do we have conferences, we pass resolutions, what can we do to effectuate these changes? And does the system work for us? I've been very encouraged by what we've been able to do at the department. Three women may not be enough, but it's two more than we ever had before. And Alexis and I are both in programs that cut across all program lines, so we have input into every area in which the department's involved. And this does enable us to get more exposure for the women's problems. I don't think we've accomplished enough yet, but we have done, in the very short time in which we've been in office, some things that I think demonstrate the kind of change that women officials can execute quickly. One of the first areas of concern was the apprenticeship and construction trades. Here are jobs that pay well, that large numbers of women are already trained for, and they certainly are qualified for and could be trained for. The department, since 1967, has had regulations regulating federally registered apprenticeship programs, and these regulations have required goals and timetables for minority men. They have not required goals and timetables for women. And one of the first things we sat down together on was to get those regulations changed. And in September, the department issued proposed regulations, which for the first time would require goals and timetables for women, and which also, because of the experience in California where the goals were set at 5%, made clear that goals would normally not be acceptable if they were less than 20% for the non-traditional apprenticeship trades. We also, at the same time, issued regulations requiring goals and timetables for women in construction. Currently, less than 1.2% of the construction workers in this country are women. The construction industry immediately descended upon the department to tell us how you couldn't possibly, we set a goal, a very modest goal of 3% for the first year and 5% for the second year. Told us that you could not possibly find women who would be willing or able to do this kind of work. And I just want to share with you an experience I had 2 weeks ago. And Alexis, I'm going to drag you on my next trip. I went to Fort Hood and talked to 50 young women, and it just made me proud to be a woman. I wanted to come back and do an article for Newsweek and give it national publicity. These women, and they were basically young Army recruits, they were engaged as pilots, mechanics, tank mechanics, aircraft mechanics, truck mechanics. They were operating bulldozers, big cranes, sheet metal workers, welders. They had been selected for the last 2 years as Soldier of the Year, won this year not only at Fort Hood but at FORSCOM, which includes the five major Army bases in the southern states. I talked to four women lieutenants who lead platoons made up of men soldiers and saw them on maneuvers. And these are just talented women. You're proud that they're sisters. And when they leave the military, they all indicated a strong interest in sticking with these non-traditional jobs. One of the other areas that we focused on is the whole problem of occupational health and safety. We are concerned that the protective levels established by the current regulations do not protect the childbearing potential of women, that you have to make a choice to risk your future child or work, keep your job. And Dr. Bingham is committed to setting levels that will protect not only adult men and women, but will protect their childbearing capabilities. And I may point out that although this issue first arose as a woman's issue, because science has known for some time that exposure to vinyl chloride monomers or to lead can affect the woman's capability to have a child that wouldn't be deformed in some way, that science is now demonstrating that it is just as dangerous for the man and that they can cause mutated and deformed children, and that their exposure to chemicals at these levels, which although thought to be safe for adults, are not safe for a future generation of Americans. At the same time, however, and this is something that I know concerns working women everywhere, we will not allow regulations to establish dual standards, one for men and one for women, and thereby encourage a whole new generation of restrictive, protective legislation that will encourage the exclusion of women from these jobs. This is not a false fear. Most protective legislation started out to benefit women and ended up hurting women. And we already have had suggestions that lead standards and vinyl chloride standards be set so that if women do the job, the company has to spend more money to reach a safer level, which obviously leads to the exclusion of women. Most tire companies will not employ women because they're afraid of their potential liability if the woman bears a damaged child. Lead factories will not employ women for the same reason. Last month, one of the country's largest chemical companies notified the women, and they notified us at the department, that they would either have to find another job in the company or be laid off permanently in 6 months' time. Now, we intend to take very decisive action against these companies. We feel that women have the right to choose to work in unsafe conditions. We would prefer that we could bring about an immediate change in the American workforce so that none of us would be exposed to unsafe working conditions. But I find the sanctimonious attitude of employers who have always discriminated against women, who now say they're doing it for our protection, somewhat irritating, particularly when one of the most dangerous environments may be the hospital where women are employed. And I haven't even heard proposed a safety standard to adequately deal with exposures to radiation and various kinds of drugs and chemicals. And I do share the concern of the women in the union movement that this is just another device to keep women out of the better jobs. We also have proposed in the recent lead standards a rate retention, which would require the company to transfer an employee, male or female, until their body has reached a safe level, keep their high rate, and then transfer them back to that job. In fact, that is what is typically done for the male worker. Most of these health standards require constant monitoring, and when the employee reaches an unsafe level, for example, too much lead in the blood system, then they're removed from the job. Police, if they're injured in duty, they're given desk work until they're able to go back to their prior position, and they're kept at their same rate of pay. So we have made a proposal along those lines. That, of course, doesn't deal with the problem of health dangers that would affect the woman prior to her becoming pregnant. But this is something we will experiment and explore. I might say that we are also very concerned with professional women. And although professional women were originally excluded from many of the protective discrimination statutes, they have since 1972 enjoyed statutory protection. The Equal Pay Act was extended to protect them in that year. Title VII was amended to apply to college institutions, and Title IX of the Education Act was added to give additional protection to professional women. There has been very little litigation involving their job rights. We have committed ourselves, we have agreed with Women's Equity Action League, to institute no less than 10 major cases against institutions of higher education in fiscal year 1978. We have also stepped up our equal pay enforcement, and we have the first major university case involving the entire salary structure currently in process at Memphis State. It has now been in trial for 4 weeks. It's been recessed for a month in order for the court to handle its criminal calendar. but we think that will be a precedent-setting case on the whole issue of women's rights in the universities. I noticed in reading the proposed plan of action that many of the proposals affect the kinds of things we're doing at the department, and that some of the proposals we are currently responding to, and that some we have the capacity to respond to. And I think there, Alexis and Eula and myself can play a major role. The conference recommends increased enforcement of the minimum wage law. I've always considered this to be the first civil rights plank in this country, because women are the ones who are traditionally paid the least. Women for many years were kept outside the minimum wage law. It didn't apply to their industries. We have made two major accomplishments in the last 6 months in this administration. First, we worked and got the largest increase in the minimum wage that we've ever had in its history. And starting on January 1, it will be raised to $2.65 an hour. And on January 1, 1981, it will go up to $3.35 an hour. Perhaps as significantly, we got rid of the second lower wage rate for those industries which employ women. For years, the Fair Labor Standards Act has had one higher rate for most people, and then a lower rate for retail workers, laundry workers, school workers, the very occupations where women predominate. And that dual wage structure was done away with, and they enjoy the same protection as other workers. There was a move to exclude domestic workers from the bill. We got them covered in 1974. And this is very important, particularly in the Southwest, where many of our Hispanic women are employed as full-time live-in for the children and the housework. And I don't know if you've seen out here the various articles in the Washington papers about the slavery conditions of domestics brought in by foreigners who are working in the various international agencies who have been kept in an absolute state of peonage. And we were able to use this law to help them, and we fought quite a battle on the Hill to keep protection for this group of workers who traditionally have been among the very lowest paid. One thing I might just mention, there were a few other items in the proposed plan, particular concern for older workers, that we should do something about mandatory retirement. I'm happy to report that after some vigorous campaigning, we got the president's support for a bill which at least raises the mandatory retirement age to 70. And that bill passed the Senate 88-6 and the House 359-4, which shows you where public sentiment lies. That bill will not require people to retire earlier, nor will it delay your pension if you wish to retire at 65 and start collecting Social Security, but it will enable you to work longer if you want to. Very important for women. The average private pension for women in this country is $90 a month. For men, it's considerably more. Now, there's not anyone that can live on $90 a month. True, you get a little pittance from the Social Security, but for a family of two, the Social Security payment is $4,040. Which is not enough to maintain a reasonable standard of living. So recognizing that most people have not been able to set aside this large nest egg for retirement, that they have had family responsibilities and expenses up through their 60s, we felt this was at least a first step. Labor law reform is another issue raised in the conference report. The proposals quite accurately point out that women are among the most unorganized workers in this country, which has led to low rates of pay in the industries which have populated themselves with women, and I suppose the clothing manufacturers are among the best examples. The president did transmit a message to Congress this year recommending major reforms in the labor law, which are designed to facilitate union organization where that's what the employees want. There's nothing in the bill that requires unionization, but it does protect workers from the kind of economic harassment they faced when they wanted to organize. Currently, under the current law, if an employee was fired for trying to organize, his only recourse was 10, 12, 15 years later to get a court order restoring him to his job and giving him the difference between what his salary would have been and what he actually earned. Well, since everyone has to go out and earn a salary, everyone eventually found another job. Maybe they had to find two jobs to do as well. And the company ended up owing nothing. So there was no disincentive for this kind of economic harassment. Under the president's proposal, which has passed the House, I might add, the employer would have to pay back damages, and there would not be mitigation. You could not credit against the back wage obligation monies which you had earned in other employment. And there are a number of other features which are designed to facilitate the organization of employees who want to band together in order to bargain collectively with their employer. One thing I always like to emphasize in these discussions is that when we talk about working women, we're not just talking about women who work outside the home. 47% of the adult female workforce works full-time in the home. And as you know, one of the key proposals in the conference report is to take action to protect the homemaker. This is not something the government this is not something that the government has taken any action on up to now, but it is something that I feel the women in government can campaign actively for. As you know, there has been legislation introduced to extend Social Security and pension protection to homemakers. There are other bills to help the displaced homemaker, and this is something we get involved in when women find themselves divorced or widowed in their 40s or 50s and have to return to the job market with very little training or with skills that have become rusty. And we're very much concerned with getting these women back into the job market. We have an Age Discrimination in Employment Act, which prohibits discrimination based on age. This is very important to the mature woman. And we also have devised several CETA programs which focus on the problem of the displaced homemaker. And this is something we need to do much more of. There has been some discussion by Congressman Ribicoff. We would like to see more use of CETA discretionary money in taking care of the problems of the older worker. I think one of our concerns, and this gets into the lack of any economic value placed on the homemaker, that our society really doesn't place an adequate value on this work. The homemaker, you know, that isn't included in our gross national product. There's no salary for that work. We had a recent case at the department, an equal pay case, and it involved short order cooks, a male short order cook and three women short order cooks. And the court in North Dakota found that the man was worth more money because he'd gone to cooking school for 6 months. And we argued, you know, these women have been cooking for their families. for 30 years. In fact, some of them had been employed on ranches, farms, where they had cooked, if not just for the family, but for 12, 15, 20 ranch hands. And the court couldn't see that they were just disregarding that kind of experience and crediting instead what a man who'd never done any cooking learned in a six-month extension course at a local North Dakota university. I think that the treatment of women in the home very much is reflected very much in the pay structure in society generally. Most of the occupations that women went into had their derivation from the home. Women prepare and serve food. They're dietitians, they're cooks, they're waitresses. They sew clothes. They're employed in our clothing manufacturers. They launder clothes. They teach the children, and they care for the sick. These are things they did in home. And these are occupations that all carry a low wage rate despite the enormous responsibility and skill required to perform them well. There is a volume in government called the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, which I'm embarrassed to say is published by the Department of Labor. And until the Women's Bureau got hold of that volume 2 years ago, they give you a skill level for each occupation. And locker room attendants at country clubs, whom you should all know are male, had a higher skill rating than stenographers and a substantially higher skill rating than a nurse for a child. And I find it incredible that we would value handing someone his clubs more highly than someone to whom we entrust children. I think one of the issues that concerns women and is this value placed on their work. Now, you all know we have the Equal Pay Act. The department enforces the Equal Pay Act, and since it was passed in 1963, we filed some 1,500 lawsuits and collected over $150 million in back pay. We had a very satisfying case just recently in Texas involving, I'm pleased to say, Dallas and not Houston, the school district involving the women custodial workers. And in that case, we recovered $1.2 million for women custodians, for many of them $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, and also obtained for the future hourly wage increases. Flourishes and trumpets. Hourly wage increases of from 87 cents to a dollar. So for women in those jobs, that was a very substantial victory for the department. But the Equal Pay Act can only be applied where you have men and women doing roughly equal work. It doesn't have to be the same work. It doesn't have to be identical. But you have to show that the basic job functions are the same. You're all teachers, you're all custodians, you're all machine operators, some kind of comparable job. And then you have to show that the skill, effort, and responsibility required to perform that job is roughly the same. Well, that's fine when you're talking about factory workers. And when the Act was passed, most factories had machine operator, male rate, female rate. So that did perform a real benefit. It should perform a real benefit in higher education, although we have yet to achieve success there. But it doesn't take care of jobs like typist, stenographer, bookkeeper, dietitian, nurse, all jobs which typically carry wage rates lower than those paid to warehouse men, bulldozer operators, or your typical male jobs. It is, I have always thought, arguable that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act could get at least to some kind of discrimination like that. Eleanor Norton, who will be here tomorrow, has funded a study to get into the whole field of job evaluation and to try to extend enforcement of Title VII into this area. They have not actually gotten any cases. The ACLU has filed a couple of cases, and the IUE has brought a few cases. One argument made by management is that the so-called Bennett Amendment, which is mentioned in the conference proposal, to Title VII, prohibits comparison of comparable work because the Bennett Amendment protects pay distinctions that are authorized by the Equal Pay Act. Now, I think it's quite clear that when the law says authorized by the Equal Pay Act, they're referring to that section of the Equal Pay Act that says you can base pay distinctions on seniority, quality, or quantity of production, and not to pay distinctions that simply aren't covered by the Equal Pay Act. Obviously, just because a state hasn't passed a law making a certain act criminal doesn't mean that it's approving of that activity. And that is the argument the women are making. Only one case has gone to the higher courts, and it was not successful. But this is an issue that we will continue to press.